As season 5 comes to an end, our best season to date, thank you everybody who has downloaded every episode and continues to listen to the Clink Stories of Redemption. Our last episode for this season is going to be dedicated to a wonderful man who we lost, someone who came into season 1 and gave us a wonderful story of redemption, Bernie Matthews. Rest easy, old friend, and our condolences and thoughts go out to your loved ones and family. Enjoy Bernie Matthews' story of redemption.
For the record, I'm done trying to make y'all comfortable. That's right. For the record, you ain't trying to grow, then it's done for you. That's right. For the record, lab on me going all the way. All the way. For the record, ain't trying to link, no time to waste. Stop calling. For the record, 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 for the record. For the record, I'm done trying to make y'all comfortable.
Here we go, another episode of The Clink, Stories of Redemption, Season 6. It has been amazing so far. We've had a little gap. We're back. 2022, this will be one of our biggest to date. We're aiming to hit that 1 million download mark, and I thank you, every one of you, who download each Monday and listen to The Clink, Stories of Redemption. Today's guest, you may have not heard of him. Gary Fay is his name. Now, this man is a little bit different to our guests so far, and I'm excited for this chat. Gary was the protector of one of our prime ministers, and I'll let Gary fill that in. He was also an Australian federal police officer for over 18 years. Gary, welcome to The Clink.
Yeah, g'day, Brent. Thanks for having me on, mate. I appreciate the chance to catch up, connect, and have a chat.
Mate, we, as you're probably well aware of, have quite an interesting and diverse guest list in our almost 60 episodes that we've put out there. For quite some time, I've really been trying to connect with somebody like yourself that's definitely an open book and somebody whom has come back from, you know, a story, which you do have, of redemption. You literally were the shadow of the Prime Minister, protecting him for many, many years. You were 30 years of age. How young? At that stage, you were the right-hand man to the Commissioner of the Australian Federal Police.
Yeah, look, that probably wasn't the start of the career, but it was definitely a couple of the highlights of it. I was quite young. There were some other young people around, but you know, I'd been in the federal police for around eight years when I landed a job on the Prime Minister's protection detail. And fortunately enough, I got a chance to run that team or one of those teams that looked after Kevin Rudd through the Kevin 07-08 period. I went back a little bit later on when Kevin Rudd was Prime Minister again in 2013, I think it was. And then after that, I managed to land a job in the Commissioner's office as his executive officer. I was pretty much, you know, responsible for the office of the Commissioner, the operational, the administrative and the strategic responsibilities of that office. And, you know, it was a fantastic opportunity. And, you know, for a young fella, certainly for a young fella, getting the opportunity to live the life right next to the Prime Minister was, you know, something that kids like me, I grew up in Mount Druitt out Western Sydney, and, you know, kids like me don't get a chance to fly on the Prime Minister's plane, and kids like me don't get a chance to sit in the big office in town. And, you know, it was surreal at times, but, you know, it was a fantastic experience and a good learning curve as
Gary,
well.
Gary, you talk about starting out in Mount Druitt. I myself am a young man, was a young man from Mount Western Sydney, Campbelltown. Mount Druitt back then, we're not too far from our age group of each other, was a very wild place, as was the Campbelltown area. Let's go back and give our listeners a real good insight to where it sort of began for you in reference to why, one, you wanted to become an officer of the Federal Police. Did you choose to go to the Federal Police? Were you not going to go to State Police? Let's go back and see who you were and why you chose that road.
Yeah, look, I think you're right, Brent. I mean, you know, back then, you know, I'm 45 now. You know, back when I, you know, I spent the first eight or 10 years at Mount Druitt, and then we moved into, you know, the Chipping Norton, Liverpool area, still Western Sydney. And, you know, it was rough-ish. It was low socioeconomic, but it was also, you know, pretty heartland Australia back then. I grew up like a typical Aussie boy. I played, you know, rugby league, I played cricket. Had a lot of mates, had a good family upbringing, you know, loving parents. And, you know, as when we moved, I ended up, you know, high school at around Moorbank, around where we lived. And one day I was looking through the careers advice book and I saw the Australian Federal Police there. And it always fascinated me. I'd always been interested in forensics, in detective work. And to be honest, my goal was the Federal Police. Look, as a 14, 15, 16-year-old, it was as simple a decision as I didn't want to at that time be a uniformed police officer.
Can you obviously had some sort of ambition to be some undercover? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, pretty much. You know, the guys I saw on the TV, the plainclothes police officers, the detectives, sure. You know, that was the stuff that excited me at that time. And you know, I didn't know the Federal Police existed as a 14, 15, 16-year-old until I read it in a book and went home and told Mum that's what I wanted to do. One of the criteria at that time, they suggested that a university degree would be beneficial to getting in. And in all honesty, I put my desire to join the Federal Police on hold, went to university, studied health science and became a PE teacher. I was a PE teacher for about 12 months and good old Mum rang one day and said, "Remember when you wanted to join the Federal Police? Well, they're hiring. Why don't you chuck in an application?" And in 1999, I went down to Canberra to start my college with the police.
How different is the AFP training and, you know, going through that motion stage by stage, getting that criterial sort of thing ticked, I suppose, as opposed to State Police or, you know, something of?
Yeah, look, I suppose I've got to be open up front. I've not had a lot to do with the State Police courses that they've done, so I don't really speak with any real qualified knowledge. But, you know, we went to Canberra. At the time, I understand that we had to pass selection before we got to go to Canberra at the time. I understand that at least New South Wales Police, which I was more familiar with, was more like a university style. You went to that course, then if you passed it, then you were offered opportunities to join the police. Whereas the Federal Police at the time were doing it in reverse. We went through a selection process, psychological testing, medicals, physicals, and all of those things. Went to Canberra for our basic training. Learned all that we needed to, or all that we were going to in that period of time, and on the basis that if we passed that, we would have a position. It was known that once you got through that, you would end up with a position. If you didn't make it through the course, you didn't have a position. But
I've had my own dealings with the AFP, and for some reason, I've always been under the assumption, and I say assumption because I don't reckon they're all fucking clever, but that, you know, the AFP was the next level of state. It's a little bit more of a leap. Now, quote me if I'm wrong, because I don't know. This is not my sort of area of expertise. I'm assuming, and I'm sure there's many others out there that, you know, you have your army, your soldiers, then you have your next level, the elite levels, you know, of your soldiers in different tasks up above those that come in a general style of entry. Is that how it is at the AFP? Because obviously the AFP does run a much more elite program. Well, I mean, today I guess they work together, the state and the AFP, from what we've seen. But I believe back in the day, they didn't really work too well together, did they? They were more sort of individually identified.
Yeah, look, I think there's probably some in the AFP that would like to think that they're the elite version. I'm sure there's some in the state police that would like to think they're the elite version. But, you know, probably to your point at the end there that, you know, 20, 30, 40 years ago, they worked together less than they do today is probably more recognition of the crime types that we work on. In my view, I don't think there's a better or worse, a more elite or lower level of policing. They ultimately just work different legislation. You know, we've got the federated model here. So the federal police are responsible for particular crime types or particular aspects of crime types, the borders in particular. So, for instance, the federal police more responsible for drug importations, state police more responsible for, you know, drug trafficking, I suppose, selling drugs, that sort of thing. But as we've got more sophisticated with crime types, we've got things like counterterrorism, which actually cross both parties. You've got cybercrime, child protection, which cross both parties now. So it was less; they were less apparent 20, 30, 40 years ago, and probably why they seem so distinct. Whereas now, you know, there is a lot of interoperability. Well, look, I haven't been there for 5 years, but I can only assume that it's better than even when I was there, which it was quite good.
I must say, you know, credit to all in reference to, as you said, you know, your child sex abuse cases, cyber crime and all that sort of stuff. You know, like I truly believe that it's absolutely 100%, and I'm just personally saying that as a survivor also. And I also understand too, and you might be able to assist here with a bit of information, and I want to touch on this because this is very important for the listener. They're not all going to understand the difference between state and AFP laws and all this sort of thing. Now, as somebody who has been convicted under state laws and also under federal, sentence indications were also very different. Court rulings were also very different in reference to the sentencing and how it was structured, even to the fact of, you know, parolees receiving parole after serving their time as a federal offender. For me, it was importation. So, you know, I know my years of parole were very strict, but I did have a better chance of coming out to society again because I was a federal offender. What is the background around that? Are you able to explain that a little bit more to why that happens that way?
Yeah, look, again, to be fair, I don't really have a good deal of knowledge in terms of that, only to say that, again, with the federated model, we have different systems. You might find the same difference would be experienced between New South Wales and Western Australia. New South Wales and Victoria, the way the system is set up is that, you know, each state have, you know, their own responsibilities, their own judicial process. Their own limitations, you know, their own sizes of their workforces and, you know, the sizes of their prisons, the amount of people in prison. And I think a lot of those probably determine what the outcomes are. And sometimes it's more personalized. You might get two people go through the same system, have completely different experience. And, you know, that probably happens in life. It doesn't matter where you go, that we all have different experiences, even if we tend to do the same thing.
Yeah, fair call. No, I respect that answer. Thank you for that. You did work incognito. You were undercover.
I probably wasn't undercover as I was out of sight.
We did touch on that in our earlier chat last week before we've come here and recorded on the Clink. Talk us through some of the times that you did spend undercover. Give us an insight to what it was and how dangerous it may have been and some of the matters that you had to deal with.
Yeah, look, I spent a couple of years in surveillance in my early days, to be honest. I'd probably only been in the AFP for a couple of years, if that, when I joined surveillance. And, you know, probably a distinction between undercover, you know, in that an undercover operative would tend to infiltrate or go into, you know, a criminal enterprise and try and be a part of that, whereas surveillance is more in the sense of trying to blend in with, you know, keep an eye on people by blending into the background and not being recognised or something like that. So
I fucking see yous everywhere. I fucking see yous. There's a couple of crafty ones, I will say that.
Everyone says that when they get caught.
I could tell you something actually about the airport because I'll let you finish. But, yeah, I knew. And tell me something. When do you ever see an AFP car coming down the western sub, heading out to the western suburbs, I was out towards Camden and Campbelltown, and here's two AFP cars coming up the other side, fully marked. It doesn't happen, mate. And I was off to a controlled delivery, so I got a feeling slightly that they might have been watching my vehicle come past.
Look, I think from personal experience, when you know that you're doing something wrong, you tend to see more people looking at you than actually are as well. But yeah, look, the surveillance, I loved it. Look, I was a kid, you know, I was 24, maybe 23, 24, and to me that was a lot of the policing that I had seen on TV, you know, sneaking around, you know, trying to take video and photos of criminals doing what criminals do, meeting people and trying to do it without them knowing. That was, to me, the ultimate game of cops and robbers. You know, I must preface that by saying there was plenty of days where I sat in a car, watched a door, and that door didn't open. It wasn't every day wasn't, you know, running around, hiding in bushes, taking photos and those types of things. But, you know, when it was on, it was quite enjoyable. It was quite a rush. Yeah, look, circumstances, as I mentioned to you the other day, there was a time I remember being in some bushes in a public park across the road from a restaurant, and one of the people we were watching in the restaurant decided to come out and take a leak in the bushes, probably about a foot and a half from from my head, and you know, I'm not sure if I was more concerned about getting busted or getting pissed on, to be honest. But
now that is something that you would have seen in your movies in the earlier days. That would have been an Eddie Murphy movie or something, wouldn't it?
Yeah, you're probably right. And you know, look, the nature of the crime type that we were dealing with, I was working in an avian strike team, as they were called at the time. It was to do with major drug importations and drug syndicates. You know, we were looking at people that were serious criminals, people that you know could suspect at the time wouldn't have been too happy to be arrested. You know, they were hanging around unsightly types. And you know, at any stage, you know, you get caught in, you know, somewhere that you shouldn't be and you're on your own. It's you know, it does get the hairs to stand up on the back of your neck. But that's part of the training as well. You know, that's why you go through the training. That's why you work in teams. That's why you become a trusted member, and also, you know, trust your team to get through those. And you know, as I said, it, you know, a lot of days were spent sitting in a car, but you know, a lot of them were pretty exciting for a young kid that thought he was bulletproof. But you know, it was a nice place to be.
Gary, did you ever have any one of those moments where you literally were thinking you've been pinged, something could happen, and you know, you need to start thinking on your feet?
Yeah, look, there's probably two that come to mind. One was probably a little more hairy than the other. I remember being down Chinatown once where I literally walked straight head on into the guy that we were surveilling. It was in a bar, and as we come face to face, again, as a kid, everything went through my head like, that's it. He knows exactly who I am. The job's blown. That was my first thought. I wasn't too worried about me necessarily. And then B, after that, you know, it was more about safety and who else knows. So, you know, that ended up not being that much of a big deal. But again, at the time, walking head on into him was a bit interesting. But there was another time I was out your old stomping ground, Campbelltown Way, and knew that or looked like there was going to be some sort of handover, or at least a meeting between a couple of people we were looking at. And I managed to get out there a little before everybody else, got myself in another part of these bushes. We knew that the guys that were involved were likely to be armed and have arms at their disposal, or at least, you know, somewhere close by. And it just so happened the truck and the cars that they pulled up in did so about 3 metres from where I was laying. And my team wasn't that close to me at that time. And they were calling me on the radio, asking me if I was okay, asking me for updates. And being as close as I was to anybody, I had almost zero ability to communicate back, apart from, you know, clicking a microphone button to say I'm at least still here. And I wasn't very well concealed, so it was probably about a 15-minute period where my backside was puckering like nothing else. my hand was on the firearm, because I dare say if they had have seen me, you know, I don't know that they had guns on them, but they certainly wouldn't have been too happy to see a fella laying in the grass there or in the bushes. So, yeah, it became a little bit stressful, but you know, again, it's part of the territory. It's something that that happens, and you just got to hope that it goes your way sometimes.
Do you sit back now, some years later, and still see names pop up and go, I know that bloke, I remember that, especially at the moment with, we won't get down the rabbit hole, obviously for legal reasons, I suppose, and also to just the way that it's all panning out at the moment, but this Annan, which we're all, I'm sure you're very well of, having been around the federal police and understanding more than probably most of how it all works. Is there people that, you know, are still going after all these years that you would have gone, shit, I thought you would have hung the boots up by now, mate?
Look, there likely is. I don't follow the papers as much. And to be fair, most of my, if you want to call it policing work, probably ended around 2003, 2004. Yeah. Did a tiny bit, you know, 2004, 2005, but primarily from 2003 onwards, I worked in close protection, worked in the commissioner's office, more strategic roles. So, you know, anyone that's still battling around now probably wasn't too high up back in the day or high up enough for me to recall. Look, it's nice sometimes you see some old shows, you know, on the TV and, you know, tend to recognise stories, you know, probably not necessarily stories of criminals or crooks that I would have worked on, but certainly those that my team and my bosses had worked on and spoken about. And, you know, I'm like everybody else that, you know, it's an exciting story to hear and watch on TV. And, you know, you can recall some of the stories your boss would tell you about, you know, that crook here and there. And but that I personally know or worked on, none that would come to mind or that I'd know.
What was the biggest case you worked on?
Look, the biggest case I worked on was one that I had almost nothing to do with. I came out of college probably about October, November 99, and in the February 2000, they asked who wants to go out on a customs vessel, trace some drugs up and down the coast, and it was Christmas time. I was young. I put the hand up, so I was the most junior person on that boat. Subsequently, the boat's name was the Nary War. I still remember that. 500 kilos. I think it was 520 kilos of cocaine. And from my understanding, it was the biggest white powder seizure that Australia had at that time. The grand total of my involvement was probably about 1%. But I did get to ride the Nary War back to shore as it was getting dragged back by
with all
customs.
The coke.
Yeah, oh no, I think they'd taken the coke off it. But,
Of course not. Let's just, that's evidence.
Yeah, did I say 520 kilos? I meant 500.
and you know, that's another thing that I'm going to ask you, because, I mean, you don't get the opportunity to speak to somebody that's lived in this role, and whether you answer it or not, I mean, without naming people, was there times there that you may have known or seen of some sort of... let's call it corruption?
No, never. Look, I probably joined at a time when a lot of it...
I have to ask, mate. I do.
No.
I'd be silly not to.
That's fair enough. Yeah, and look, I'd answer if I did. And to be honest, if I did, I probably would have spoken about it before this, because it's, you know, whilst I'm sure we'll get to my own story later on, it's certainly not something that I would appreciate in the workforce. And as I mentioned before, you know, you've got to trust these guys implicitly when you go out on the road. So, you know, look, there's probably different ways and means that some people operated. I wouldn't call it corruption, but again, I joined at the back end of 1999. You know, there was a lot of royal commissions and inquiries through the late 80s, early 90s into the police forces. And that probably cleaned a lot of it up. At least made people that might have been involved in it a little more, you know, behind closed doors, or at least pull their heads in. So in terms of me seeing it or coming across it, there wasn't anything. And, you know, in fact, I think almost to a person, most of the people I work with were, you know, in it for, you know, for good reasons. Maybe for the excitement, but you know, as I said, it was, you know, we all played cops and robbers when we were kids, and, you know, it's just the grown-up version of it.
I must admit, there's probably listeners out there that were just sitting there waiting on the edges of their seat for something then. But I respect what you just said.
There might be some people I work with that were sitting on the edge of their seat as well.
I've no doubt, mate. You reckon that phone might start ringing over the next couple of days? Look, in all honesty, but no, I get that and I respect that. And I think that, you know, it wouldn't matter what area of work you're in or sports, club or group, you know, on a professional level, that you do have to trust the person next to you. And if that person, you know, I guess is corrupted or is tempted to corruption in any way, shape or form, it can make, you know, you both very vulnerable and make you feel very insecure, I suppose, if the time ever came that you did need that person 100%.
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah.
No, look, different to a co-offender just giving you up.
No, that's exactly right. Look,
it's fucking insane.
You know, on that point, there is a lot of similarities between both sides of the fence that, you know, that we worked on, especially when you work, you know, organised crime type of scenarios. And, you know, there's hierarchies, there's structures, there's, but there's vulnerabilities as well. And, you know, I suppose on the police side, it's the job to try and identify the vulnerabilities in the criminal side. And on the criminal side, it's the job to try and identify the vulnerabilities in the police side. And again, it's that game of cops and robbers, and one team's going to win and the other team's not.
Do you miss it?
It's an interesting question. There's parts of it I miss. I mean, I've thought about it as a 45-year-old. I don't think I'd want to be doing the things I was doing at 24. There's an element of the problem solving. There's probably an element of the, you know, thinking on your feet part that I do miss. For a little while, there was elements of, you know, the camaraderie that, you know, that I missed. I certainly left a lot of people behind that were friends or were considered friends. And there's that part that I miss. You know, but I probably missed it more 4 or 5 years ago than I do now. I don't really reflect on that part in that way. You know, I had a fantastic time there, but you know, I had a good time in high school and I don't wish I was back there. And, you know, I had a good time as a kid and I don't wish to believe in Santa Claus again. So, you know, I've moved past that period, and it was good for, you know, I enjoyed what I did, but you know, whether I want to be there or not, I'm not. And so I focus on something different.
I can totally relate to what you're saying there, and I'll refer to, you know, you talk about the comparisons of the good guys and the bad guys, if you want to put it that way. You know, club life, back in that period that I was a part of, clubs, motorcycle clubs, it was a brotherhood, it was a camaraderie. Look, I'm not going to go into the details of it all, it's just like you guys, you know, we know what it was all about and how things worked. But you talk about, you know, having that sense of, I guess, purpose around what you were doing, you know, the brotherhood, the camaraderie, they were there. And look, it's been 2008, 2009 for me. So there's a lot of years like yourself. Would I ever go back? No chance. Do I miss it? I miss some of the people because of the things we shared and the way that, you know, I have good memories around a lot of bad times. You know what I mean? If that makes sense. So
yeah, absolutely.
I get it, and I'm sure a lot of people out there can relate too. You know, I guess, you know, if you look at it even from, you know, the point of view, we've got a lot of NRL football players, you know, their careers come to an end, but they've been playing for 10, 15 years. It's been their life, you know. It's what they know. And then all of a sudden, they're not training anymore. They're not getting the call to go to the gym, or the family's mixing and have barbecues, and it all stops. And moving forward is, you know, that next stage of understanding who you are and, you know, what you're about as a person, one out.
Yeah, look, I think, you know, a couple of points on that. You know, I'd like to think that if we can elevate ourselves above, you know, our opinions of right and wrong, it is, you know, there's nothing that's all good and there's nothing that's all bad. And certainly there are, you know, there are similarities between, you know, your former life, my former life, as you said, you know, being a footballer. You know, you can still have good experiences, even though there's some element of bad that exists. You know, and you know, onto the, you know, the point you made about footballers or people that used to be in, you know, in your life, people that used to be in my life, the military, you know, or any stage.
Military, that, yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
doing it's tours, you know, with other brothers, you know, like that's crazy. Coming
look,
back
a man that gets to 65, 70 and retires, it's the same deal, you know. It looks, it happens to people that are married and then get divorced. Yeah. When you attach yourself to an identity of any sort, when you attach yourself to an identity of what you do being who you are, once that what is over, you are left with this, well, who am I? If I'm not a footballer, who am I? If I'm not a police officer, who am I? And I certainly, you know, confronted that in a big way myself. And, you know, a lot of the stuff that I do now is centered around that what you do isn't who you are. And if you're not able to do the work on it, on who you are during your time in your career, it becomes extremely difficult to move on. Because, you know, when we walk in a room, what's the first two questions anybody says to you? What's your name and what do you do? And so we intrinsically link what we do with our name. And, you know, we lose that. We lose a sense of us. We lose a sense of self. And, you know, whether other people want to judge that it's good, bad or indifferent what people were a part of, it still provides a family. It still provides a brotherhood, as you said. It, you know, it still provides some sense of belonging. And if you lose it, I don't care what it is, it's, you know, it can be devastating.
Definitely. And depending on how it gets taken from you or how you choose to leave it is also the other side of it too, which, you know, has either a roll-on effect or a traumas effect on the person. Let's move to the next stage of Gary's career, because I think it's really important. And we're definitely going to touch on the things you were just saying a little bit later in the conversation. But giving people that insight to, you know, your career, and then we'll touch on what brought that career down. You moved from the covert operations that you were doing as an AFP officer. What was next for Gary?
Yeah, look, I went into surveillance not long before September 11 happened. So September 11, 2001, the Twin Towers obviously came down, and close protection around the world ramped up. Everybody needed protection. And when I say everybody needed protection, the federal police's responsibility was, foreign diplomats, our own high office holders. So we have ambassadors in Australia. We have consuls general in the states, in New South Wales and Victoria and states that other countries feel that are relevant. And certain countries became a lot more heightened in terms of their security risks. Obviously the US, the UK, there was even, I think, Turkey at the time, Indonesia, the Israeli embassy and consulate. And so where, you know, before September 11, we may have looked after a handful, we all of a sudden had to look after, you know, an extra 10, an extra 15. And so there was a real need for people to go into close protection. And look, I was loving the job that I was doing at the time, but I also, it was a 10-year goal of mine in the police was to join close protection. And here I was, two or three years in, and the opportunity pops up. And so I think it was the start of 2002, I went and did a close protection course, started looking after the UK, the United Kingdom Consul General in Sydney, also the Israeli Consul General in Sydney. And, you know, that's where my protection course or my protection career really started. And I spent the most part of my career probably in close protection, at least, 40, 50% of it. Most of it was in Sydney. And then, fortunately in 2007, I got a chance to look after, to work on Kevin's team for the election. He subsequently won, and I took over one of the teams there for the next little period. And there was a little bit of a gap in there. I went to England in 2002-03. Had a couple of games of football, and got all excited about traveling the world, and then came back and got back into work. And I spent a bit of time overseas with work, but yeah, ultimately the next, probably from 2004 to 2011 was in and out of close protection. jobs.
You talk about close protection. Let's just give our listeners a little bit more insight into that. And I'd actually like to know a little bit more because, one, do you need to have been a federal police officer to be at the level of close protection or a state police officer, or can anybody go and do this close protections course? How does it work, and how do you get to that level?
Yeah, so the federal police are responsible for Australian high office holders and international dignitaries. And you know, you can go and do a bodyguard course or a close protection course to look after private citizens. So you'll see bodyguards looking after celebrities and, you know, famous people and sports people and all of that sort of stuff.
Well, I know a lot of ex-servicemen basically came back and went back over seas to look after diplomats and stuff like that in private sectors and things.
Correct, yeah. So they're all private based. I mean, if you've got some skills and experience in the military or in the police, there's every likelihood that, you know, those skills are going to transfer and you're going to be highly sought after. But in terms of the people that we looked after in the police, you know, it was a, in some places it's a joint responsibility. So yes, you have to be in the police, you have to be in the federal police. And then when we would go into New South Wales, depending on the diplomat, depending on the circumstances, would be assistance, would be joint operations, you know, would be working together. But primarily, you know, it's a police-run protection course for police-run close protection operations.
Yeah, wow. What was it like getting that call-up?
Oh, it was pretty exciting, to be honest. I mean, you know, you play sport to play for Australia. You do any job to be the boss. You do close protection, and you know, for most people, it's probably the pinnacle. It is the pinnacle. It's, you know, it's the one that you're going to be front and center. If there's going to be any issues with, you know, the need for close protection, it's most likely to be the Australian Prime Minister. And you know, again, I was a 29 year old that you know, was a little egotistical that thought I was good enough to do the job. And, you know, when the call came, I was excited. I was over the moon. You know, it's what I'd worked towards. It's what I'd trained for. And you know, it is. It's the top of your game. And you know, the pressure was on, but that's what I'd lived for, and that's what I'd wanted. And you know, it was a good experience.
I know it might be a little touching to ask, but can you share a couple of special moments, whether it be a good moment and a bad moment? We won't go into too many because I know obviously it's top secret as such. It's still.
Look, I got to say, I've never had a bad relationship with anybody I've looked after. I've looked after, you know, some important people from the US, from, you know, all over the world. And obviously the Prime Minister. I've looked after some of the Prime Minister's children, different Prime Ministers. I've had bits and pieces to do with other Prime Ministers as well as the Governor General. And I've got to be honest, I've had fantastic experiences. I was probably closest, you know, to Kevin Rudd at the time, mostly because of the requirement of, you know, what I needed to do. And, you know, I've got to say, he was always good to us. His family were always good to us. You know, it was nice to have a joke from time to time.
He's got a head on him. I don't know how he didn't laugh every day you looked at his fucking forehead, but anyway.
Yeah, and you know, look, I think that one of the great things about the job is you do get a chance to see some of these people behind closed doors. You get a chance to see what they're like, you know, on a Sunday afternoon in their shorts and singlet with their feet up, or, you know, having a swim. And you know, there is certainly an element of that is, you know, I won't say it's top secret, but it's something that you treasure and cherish. And I would imagine most people aren't going to run around sharing, you know, those stories a great deal. But look, I think Kevin and I had a pretty good relationship, at times jovial relationship. But we certainly had a joke at each other's expense, him probably at me more than me at him, knowing the roles and the responsibilities. But you know, I always felt comfortable around Kevin. He was a good guy to me. Look, there's always been stories about the way he treated people, but I got to say, you know, for part we felt like part of the family, and I certainly don't have any bad words about it.
Credit to him, obviously, for giving you that experience, because I think that's an interesting way that you've described your experience around one of our prime ministers. You say, you know, the Sunday afternoons and sitting around, obviously that, and as I said, quote me if I'm wrong, does that sort of say that you are around them and their families pretty well all the time, whether it be in their personal compound, not just at to and from Parliament House or in their travels, you know, with their media and stuff, but you actually are present at the family day?
Yeah, look, I remember saying, I think if memory serves, the election was called on the 16th of November in 2007. And I remember saying that, you know, on the 15th of December, Kevin Rudd could drive his kids to school with nobody around him. And by the 16th, he was going to be surrounded for the rest of his days as a, you know, either through the election or if he became prime minister, you know, through that period. And yeah, look, that. I suppose with some limitations, we try and be very respectful of the fact that people have families and they don't want, you know, big burly goons sitting by the pool in black suits and sunglasses while they're trying to have
That's what I mean. Is it like you sort of see in these movies, you know, like the bodyguards that just sit off and, you know, they've got the sunnies on and they're watching the front gate and the other one's parading around with his gun, you know, on the property and, you know, the kids are in the pool and they've got their arms folded. Just like, I mean, how is it for someone that would never know?
Yeah,
I mean, and I know you can't go disclosing obviously too much. It'd be too sensitive, but give us an insight, some sort of idea.
Look, I think in some parts of the world, what you've described is probably the way that it happens. Or certainly in countries where they have the ability to flood a protection team with maybe hundreds of people or hundreds of resources. We don't do that in Australia. You know, I think it's pretty common knowledge. Our teams are probably more agile. I'd like to say they're more intelligence-based, not intelligent, but intelligence-based. So we don't flood the area with hundreds of people to put up a wall. We try and, we try and give our prime ministers access or the people access to our prime ministers. You know, at the end of the day, the prime minister is a servant of the people. And, you know, to close them off from that would also cause some, you know, disruption to the country. So, you know, the answer is no. If the Prime Minister and his family is in his backyard, you know, in the pool, we would be unlikely to be sitting around that pool. You know, we would have other resources doing other things outside of view to try and allow them to have as much of a normal life, you know, as possible. That's probably as big a part of our job as looking after them is to, you know, try and allow them to have as normal a life as possible, which is probably why you end up becoming so close. You know, you do become friendly. You do go for long walks on the beach at night and, you know, we stop short of holding hands, but, you know, it's...
And I'm sure you've seen the romantic dinners now and again as well. You know, I mean, this is the bigger picture, isn't it?
Yeah, well, you can't go out to dinner without, you know, and sometimes it's just over-enthusiastic fans. It's not that everybody wants to have a go. You might just have someone that wants to shake hands and doesn't want to let go. You know, there are those people out there as well. And, you know, as energetic as they are and, you know, unlikely to hurt anybody, they still do impact on, you know, the Prime Minister's ability to have dinner. And, you know, that's not what we want.
Yeah, it's definitely a tough gig. You know, I don't get into too much politics. It is what it is. I just choose not to. I don't want to go down all the bullshit and rabbit holes and the fors and against. But I often do sit back and I think to myself, you know, what a life and what pressure you would have, especially in these day and times.
Well, I think it's difficult. I mean, there's when you're the Prime Minister, I don't think there's a right answer. Well, certainly not from the public's point of view. You know, you're going to piss off 50% of the people most of the time, you know, which does make the job difficult, in particular when you're, you know, sometimes beholden to the rest of your party and people that are fighting for their jobs, you know, in the politicians fighting for their jobs, they're trying to make decisions sometimes to save a career rather than look after the public. And, you know, certainly these days with 24-hour media cycles and, you know, social media, I imagine it would be far, far more difficult than, you know, 50, 100 years ago. There's some benefit to that. You know, you can't get away with things that you might have been able to in the past. But, you know, it's sometimes we might be better off just to let them make some decisions and get out of the way.
Yeah, well said. You talk about other parliamentarians. I'm always curious. I mean, you're the ears and the eyes. You're obviously around. You see and hear. It's your job to know. How are the knives?
Look, they're very cagey. If they exist, they're quite cagey. And look, I suppose, you know, unless you're, you know, it would be very difficult to pick those up in the jobs that we did, unless you were looking after, you know, if you were looking after the Deputy Prime Minister and it was them that was, you know, out to get the Prime Minister. Yeah, then the Deputy Prime Minister is probably having regular meetings, but we don't go into meetings typically. You know, that's yeah, even with the Prime Minister, we, you know, the room would be secure and we don't go into those. So
then when we hear about all these whistleblowers, is that the nice term?
Yeah, whistleblowers, yeah, they exist.
And then we hear of all these parliamentary, you know, goings on and shenanigans and all this sort of stuff. It must be quite interesting, especially when you're working in and around it all and, you know, someone's saying, right, this has happened, that's happening, but in your head you would probably know something different.
Yeah, look, I think, you know, and again, I'm a long way and a long time removed from, you know, from that area. My personal view is...
I don't think it's much changed, so let's fucking talk about it, because I want to know.
My personal view is it's not as exciting as whistleblowers may make out that it is.
There you go. And
I also think that we can tend to beat up a story, you know, if the Prime Minister has... you know, 10 friends around his house and they all go for a swim and someone leaves their cozzies on the fence, it's probably not that big of a deal. We've all done it. We've all, you know, been around someone's
better
house.
Better be the mistress of the Prime Minister that left the knickers on the fence that, you know, comes
exactly
out in the media,
right,
wouldn't it?
You know? And again, we're living in a day and age where somebody that has a little bit of information feels very important about themselves and, you know, would like to share. Now, that's different, in my view, to a whistleblower that's you know, filling or speaking to authorities about things that are going on that are inappropriate or wrong or, you know, illegal. That's a different kettle of fish. But, you know, someone's trying to drop a story just to give themselves a couple extra likes. Chances are, in my view, that story's at least embellished a little bit and certainly comes without context. You know,
was that a job for you guys, though, to be aware of in case it may have brought of... you know, some sort of disruption to the Prime Minister or his family or party close to him? Was it your sort of job to be on the ball for those little sneaky fucking knives, you know, like the people around just create that problem?
I think it is. I think, you know, our responsibility is to not only protect the person, but the, you know, the office, the reputation of the office, you know, again, on the basis that there's no illegality or anything inappropriate going on. I think it is. You know, you don't want cameras poking over the fence at the Prime Minister's place, whether or not there's a gun attached to it or not. It's, you know, it has the potential to, you know, to bring down the trust in the institution. And you know, that's almost as important, you know, maybe more important than the figurehead themselves. Is the trust that the people have in the institution. You know, that's ultimately, you know, I was fortunate. I liked everybody that I worked on, but, you know, I've been asked this before. My job was to protect the office of the Prime Minister. It wasn't to protect Kevin Rudd. It was to protect the Prime Minister. It just so happened to be Kevin Rudd at that time. But whether I liked Kevin or didn't like Kevin,
so it could have been Julia.
I got on very well with Julia. And to be honest, I was quite good friends with her partner Tim as well, and spent a bit of time with them. Yeah, I don't have any knowledge of what went on between Julia and Kevin, but both of them were very good to me. They were very nice to me, very friendly, and you know, again, the role is to protect the office of Prime Minister, regardless of what your personal views of that person is. And fortunately, I had, you know, good personal relationships with those people. But if I didn't, it shouldn't have made a difference, or I should have left my job.
One would think, though, that if your protection is one of the highest in the country, to which it was at that time, well, at any given time, that you're protecting a Prime Minister or, you know, someone of that calibre, would it not have been better to be in that position and have a relationship, as you've said that yours was, from a communication point of view, from a respect point of view of them, you know, and you having that conversation, or you may be suggestive of something that they may not feel comfortable or like or want to do, but it is a directive because of the sensitivity around whatever you were about to do or the movement or anything like that. I could only imagine if you didn't have that connection with those people, how difficult your job could have been.
Yeah, look, I'd like to believe that I could have still done it, but knowing everything I know now, later in life, about how, you know, how much of our, how much our thoughts, you know, and our beliefs can influence the way that we see the world and our experiences, I think it would be extremely difficult to dislike somebody intently and then also have cordial conversations with them where you know, didn't have the thought in the back of your head that this person's lying to you or they're not nice or they're doing this to upset you. You know, this is no different than any relationship. Once you get it in your head that the person is out to get you, it's going to be almost impossible to see anything nice in them, and then makes it difficult to communicate. So, look, I'd like to think it wouldn't matter, but I do think that it's most likely helpful to a point. I do also think you could probably get too close, which may you know, impact your ability to think objectively, you know, in the circumstances as well.
Your next step, assistant to the commissioner.
Yeah.
Wow.
Not bad.
You really climbed the ladder and obviously didn't suck cock, but worked very hard to get there.
That's right. Yeah, I was a good golfer.
Yeah. Could play a stroke, eh?
Play golf, right?
Yeah. Good stroker.
Exactly.
What was your average? Par 3, par 4, birdie?
I washed a lot of balls.
Mate, like, wow. I'm actually more taken back that a man or a woman, and let's not go into the whole only man thing, but anybody that could do this job was privy to these positions at the age that you were. And that's not discrediting you, but wow, that's huge, you know. Like would one think that somebody a bit more sort of years of experience around certain things would be in these positions as opposed to a younger person coming up and through, you know? How was it getting to these places and then all of a sudden, you know, you're right beside the commissioner, you're his eyes, ears, and shadow for the
ASP? Yeah, look, by the time I ended up working directly with the commissioner, I was a little older. I think I was about 38 at that stage, but it was 2011. So what would I have been then? 34-ish. Well, I got a call. The commissioner at the time, I remember, joked with me. He used to come up to Sydney and I was still in protection. So we, you know, help out, you know, picking him up, taking him a few places. And I had a good relationship with him. And he said to me once, "You're going to have to come to Canberra." I'd been working in Sydney my whole life. I was from there. And I jokingly said to him, "When you get me a decent enough job, I'll come down." And, you know, that sort of went by and by. And, you know, 6 months later, 12 months later, I got a phone call from the deputy commissioner and I shit myself. I thought, I've done something wrong here. It was at Christmas time. I ignored the message for a few days. I've got to be honest. I pretended I heard the message and then I was taking a few days off. So
I'm going to ask you something in this conversation a little bit later, and I'm sure you're already on to what my next question will be there. But right, go for that phone call.
So I waited until, I think it was the 4th of January. I rang him back and he said, "Do you want to come down to Canberra to work as my project officer?" It was the title of the role. And he said, "Why don't you come down for a month to see if you like it and if you want to stay?" And look, to be fair, I had a lot of respect for that deputy commissioner who became the commissioner. And, you know, my answer to him was, "I don't think there's going to be a no from me. I'm coming down." And my biggest concern was that he wouldn't have liked me and I would have been out of the job in a month. So I went down there 2011 and worked for the deputy commissioner as his project officer, staff officer. A couple of years later, Kevin Rudd got back in as the Prime Minister, and I'm led to believe that the Commissioner certainly asked me, would I go back? So I don't know how that transpired, but would I go back? So I ended up going back on Kevin Rudd's protection team for 2013. I think the election was 2013 as well, and stayed there for a little while. Went back to the Deputy Commissioner's office, and later that year, 2014, he became the Commissioner in the September, and asked if I would be his executive officer, you know, which was a trumped up project officer or staff officer, but gave me, you know, a little bit more of an expanded responsibility It was around the time of a lot of terrorist incidents in Australia as well. So we also had heightened security on the commissioner. Thankfully, because of my previous role, I fulfilled that as well. So I was his security officer, strategic advisor in some sense. I won't say I was the only one. There's definitely a lot of others. But, you know, I was sitting next to him in cars, on planes. We were talking through everything and nothing to do with where we were heading in the AFP. And, you know, it was a role that was, look, to be honest, that was probably the role I loved the most. I loved the strategy. I loved trying to figure out where the organization might've been going. Whether I was listened to or not was irrelevant, but I got the chance to sit at the big table sometimes and have my own views on where we should go. And again, it was like problem solving on steroids. And you know, as I said, I think that was my favorite role. The commissioner and I were, I thought, best friends at the time. I think he thought the same thing. And, you know, I got to spend every day at work with my best mate, doing stuff that, you know, I really enjoyed. And yeah, it was fantastic.
With all these highs, there definitely was a massive low for you.
Yeah. Look, it
and I'm not here to kick you in the guts, because this is what the Clink's all about, is sharing with people the high and sharing that massive low. For you, you fell from grace.
Yeah, and look, I think to be fair, the minute I tell anybody that I battled addiction, their first thought is drugs and alcohol. It wasn't for me. I now have a view that most people are addicted to escapism, and my substance was gambling. But if we backtrack a little and we talk about the highs of my career, you know, 2007-08 with the Prime Minister, 2013 the Prime Minister, 2014-15 the Commissioner. Over that entire period, I was, and I say silently, I was battling a major depressive disorder. So I had major depression through that whole period. So, you know, it didn't dawn on me. It certainly, you know, it was something that I masked even from myself. I didn't believe that a guy who had achieved all the success that I had, that everybody outside of my life looked at me and thought, this guy's got it all together. You know, he's got the job, the career, he's got a family, the houses. This guy, you know, he's doing well. 10 years of that, I was struggling, you know, and progressively worse. And my escape was gambling. I'd gambled for most of my life, you know, horses, some cards, some poker machines. But from 2007 onwards, apart from a few times where I managed to kick it, it got progressively worse.
For the record, I'm done trying to make y'all comfortable. That's right. For the record, you ain't trying to grow, then it's done for you. That's right. For the record, lab on me going all the way. All the way. For the record, ain't trying to link, no time to waste. Stop calling. For the record, 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 for the record.